Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Oh, right. So you're just going to come in and ask her lab questions?
Yes.
No.
So is this
I'm looking through this and I don't find anything that says hero life.
It's just ask questions of us and we'll answer, right? Is that basically, we don't really have anything planned, because I don't.
Yeah. I mean, it is called Ask the GM. So.
Yeah. And so I kind of, any questions you want, whether it's like how to run your game or how to kill your characters off or how to not get your characters killed off, or I guess even like questions about Pathfinder or Paizo or Starfinder or whatever, we'll answer them. And if we don't want to answer them, we'll tell you we're not going to answer.
Either that, or we're just going to make something up.
We can do that too.
A lie.
Yeah, I've got a really good sense photo.
I'm just saying. Oh, get out the list.
We don't necessarily care if you know we're lying, though.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
I'm not going to try the bluff. Just let me know. It's like mine.
All right. What I like to refer to as Game Master.
Yeah, I think so. Like James, let's all introduce ourselves. Howdy, everyone. I hope you're having a great show. My name is Stephen Radley McFarland. I know it's a mouthful. You can call me SRM, Stephen, hey, jerk, whatever. I am the senior designer on the design team with you.
And I am Amanda Hammond-Coots. I am the development coordinator at Paizo.
I'm Spencer Crittenden. I am on a podcast called Harmontown as a DM, and I make a show called Harmon Quest that's about Pathfinder, and we play Pathfinder.
And I'm James Jacobs. I am the Pathfinder creative director. And real quick, you just reminded me of something I never told you about your name, Stephen, SRM.
Yeah.
Always makes me think of Battletech.
Oh, yeah.
And like short-range missiles.
I'd like to think it's a little longer range, but okay.
We'll see.
From the far end of the table.
So who's calling on people? You just had a lot of practice calling.
Yeah, I'll do that. So your hands will go up. If I point to you, go ahead and ask your question. If I don't point to you and I'm ignoring you, sorry. Who's got a question?
First, what's your proudest moments as a GM?
Ooh,
if you can pick one.
Yeah. I'm not humiliated.
We'll get to that question.
James?
This question, for some reason, comes up a lot in these types of panels, so I will go with, if I've already told this story to you on a previous panel, that's your fault for coming to this panel twice. I was running back in, I think, early third edition D&D, where we were playing Bruce Cordell's best ever adventure, Firestorm Peak. And has anybody read or played that adventure? Oh, more people should check it out. It's basically
best Cthulhu ever.
Yeah, it's big dungeon crawl. It's the adventure that introduced the Far Realm into Dungeons and Dragons. And there's a big dungeon crawl through a mountain. And in the middle of it, there's this minecart section. You know, like Indiana Jones, where people jump in minecarts. And there's a bunch of Duergar dwarves mining in there, or Midero, or both of them, or something like that. So it's just crazy antics all over the place. And I had a group of like six or seven people who were playing at the Wizards of the Coast offices. So they had these big, big tables. And we were all sitting around the tables. And this whole minecart chase started, with the player characters jumping in these minecarts and pulling the brakes off, and like Duergar chasing after them, and they're rattling around. And I kept having them make all these saving throws and stuff like that. And I knew at the very end was that landing in this like underdark market where there was like Darrow's selling pet sturges and Drow selling poisons and all sorts of weird stuff going on. So as they were hurtling down these like minecart stuff and like having to make split second decisions between left and right and all this stuff, I was describing in this rapid fire succession of like all of these encounters they were basically skipping. And the first few were like actually things that were in the game. Like, oh, you see a bunch of Darrow working in a forge, or you see a bunch of Duergar whipping their slaves and all this stuff like that. And as they just keep going and going and going, I'm just firing these things off and off and off and off. And they're slowly getting more and more ludicrous. And the player character's like, oh, wait. And I just was still rattling off so they couldn't stop. And it was one where they shot by and it's like, you see a bunch of Duergar standing around watching a pair of cats box. It was a completely just goofy thing to wire cats down in this underdark area. And one of the players just leaned back, just woo-hoo-hoo, just sort of laughing, and he flew out of his chair, landed on his back. I thought I killed him. he came up laughing. So I guess my proudest moment was the day I made somebody fall out of their chair with my words.
I don't know. I'm continually disappointed by my GMing, so really, I only think of it in shame and insecurity, I think. So yeah, sorry.
That was heavy.
I know, right?
Amanda, your turn.
Oh, all right. So now for something
easy to follow that.
Yeah. No, anything is better.
So I used to do a lot of convention GMing, you know, before I was a freelancer, before I was a pro, so to speak, you know, if you can call us that. And so I would both GM for folks that would just kind of come up to the table and also for my group of friends that I would go to Gen Con with. Every year, and we were running through like a homebrew campaign, and the timing matched up that everybody that was in the group was also going to be with us at Gen Con. So I was like, okay, we'll run at Gen Con. And we ended up, you know, in one of those rooms up in the second or third floor of the hotel, I think the Marriott that year. And it was just, it totally went off the rails. Like the situation was, the PCs were like supposed to have come upon this like great battle. There's this big like orc army that's rushing at them, and they're supposed to like sort of try to like maybe fight little groups here and there. But I had planned out that they were going to get captured, and the way the scenario was going to go out was that they were going to get captured. They're going to get taken back to the war party. They were going to have to escape and like, you know, confront the leader of this orc army. So it's like, okay, you see all this stuff going on, and like, my husband and his cousin came up with this ridiculous plan in which his cousin was playing a halfling who was going to ride on the back of my husband's human barbarian, and they were going to intimidate this wave of orcs. And it's like, this is the most half-baked, ridiculous plan ever. So it's like, okay, tell me what you're doing. And they describe it, and they're like, yeah, we're going to make it as intimidating as possible, and like, this orc over here who's already fallen, we're going to cut his head off, and we're going to haul it up to this group of orcs, and we're going to scream about the blood of our enemies. So I was like, all right, roll intimidate. They both roll natural 20s. So it's like, oh my gosh, all right, well, you know what? Sure, yes, and. The orcs became intimidated when they saw this screaming human barbarian and this little tiny halfling holding up this orc head rushing toward them. And it's like, okay, the waves of the orcs part, and you guys are able to escape to the forest. So then, like, the way that everything had gotten described, there was this big old crowd of people at the time, and when that happened, everybody just sort of, like, cheered, and the hotel staff had to come in and be like, is everything okay? And they're like, oh yeah, you know, severed orc heads and human barbarians and orc armies, and they're like, okay, yeah, fine, nobody's hurt. So I'd say probably when we got the audience of folks there with their ridiculous intimidating roles.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You know, it's really kind of hard for me to center on one thing. Like, I think about all of the years that I've been playing these sorts of games, and I'm old. And I've seen table flips. I've had, you know, players in my group get married because I introduced them in the game and stuff like that. There's been a lot of really good times. But I think my favorite times are finding a young person who really wants to learn how to play this game and really doesn't have an avenue for it. And for some reason, I eventually get these people in my game, which seems not very intuitive because I have a very foul mouth and inappropriate sense of humor. But it actually always works up just fine. And one of my favorite players of this ilk actually just graduated from college and wants to become a game designer. Which I think is crazy for him to do, but, and I've tried to tell him, no, don't do that, don't be like me. Yeah, I think my favorite parts about being GM just in general is you know, sharing something that's not only fun but actually can affect your life in a really positive way. So, and I'm also trying to, you know, kind of balance out the heavy shit that you laid down.
Yeah, no, that really got everyone's mind off of it until just now.
Yep. Okay, we got another question.
Yeah.
This is something you guys hear all the time, I'm sure. What's the best way to start freelancing and start a game designing career?
Don't do it.
Aside from that.
It's tricky. I mean, back in the day, there was Dragon and Dungeon magazine, and that was a really great way to just send in, you know, proposals for short articles or adventures or something like that. And that's how I got started writing for Dungeon. Today, it's an entirely different realm. I mean, one of the big ways to get your name out there is to start doing stuff. I mean, you can self-publish, you can just start putting things down on your websites and stuff like that. Start working for third-party publishers. Go to conventions like this and just talk to us. We always do at conventions, not just Paizo, but any company you want to work for. We'll do like writing workshops or freelance workshops and stuff like that. So, luck is unfortunately a big part of it. I would say, for example, go into college and like study English and writing and stuff like that, which is what I did. But then, like I was just mentioning, Bruce Gravel, really, he's, I think, a biologist.
Yeah.
Jason Baldwin's an architect. When you get into game designing, you're not just designing rules for a game, you're designing like entire worlds. And the more breadth you take to whatever you're doing, you know, the better you're going to be. Like as long as everybody can, you know, design right and all that stuff, and you happen to say be a meteorologist, all of a sudden the company you're joining has somebody that can build their weather programs for their system or their rules or something like that. So, I guess a combination of be lucky, be passionate about your writing, and be stubborn for the conventions. Don't be afraid of rejections.
Yeah, honestly, being professional is a huge part of it. If you are coming up to us, well, you know, relatively
small. Right, relatively.
If you're coming up to us and you have a business card, you know, especially if you're in some sort of publishing side thing or you've got, you know, like a journalism degree or an English degree, like James said, if you're coming up to us and you're giving us a business card, you know, and, you know, you're following up maybe with an email if we ask you or something like that, and, you know, when you do get work, if it's third party or through whatever avenue, if you always hit your deadlines, if you communicate, if you turn over a clean copy, like, that really honestly goes as far as anything from, you know, just weeding out the folks who want to freelance from the people who are freelancers.
And another real thing that just real quick came to mind is take part in, like, organized play programs. Because that's a huge network of people that game and all of that. They're always looking for volunteers and helping other things. And we create so many adventures for Pathfinder Society and coming up for Starfinder. We're always looking for new writers. It's a difficult thing to get into because, you know, we want to make sure that you are, you know, capable of turning out a great work.
Go back here then.
So I run a lot of adventure paths, and I've noticed that some of my friends, when we do adventure paths with them, they modify slightly, and sometimes they do it so well I don't even notice. Like, I'd like to modify some of mine, but I'm not very good at just, like, you know, figuring out what's balanced and what is everything. Do you guys have any tips for how to, you know, do a modification without it being, like, either, you know, a death fest or just, like, a, you know, walk in the park?
Partially, mostly if you're playing with a stable group. Modification actually works best not when you're so much tweaking the numbers, but making sure that you hit all of the exciting parts that you know those players enjoy. Or tweaking an encounter so it's all like, oh, well, they have a Slayer. I'm going to make something interesting for the Slayer to do here, because maybe the core of it doesn't do that. So I think the best modifications are knowing your audience and doing interesting things for them. Rather than, I'm going to add 5 more goblins and stuff.
One relatively easy way to change things up is to just run the game as is, but describe them differently. So if your player characters are, say, out in the woods and they are attacked by a wyvern, don't tell them that a wyvern swoops down and attacks them. Say, all right, you hear this weird buzzing, and all of a sudden this wasp-like thing, it's about the size of a horse, but it's got a long snake for a tail, and at the tip of its tail, it's got, like, this poisoning spinner, and is shrieking like a little newborn baby. And as it swoops down, you smell, like, this overwhelming sense of, like, cinnamon, and you will never like cinnamon again because this thing is so monstrous. And your players are going to freak out because, like, they don't know what the poison-spinning cinnamon bug is. But it's just using the stats for a wyvern. And you know that a wyvern is what it is, and you know, like, the party is equipped in theory for a wyvern, but they're not going to know what it is, and it's going to get a lot more different response. Especially, this works really well for groups that have been playing games for a long time.
Yeah. I have an encyclopedia player. So.
Yeah, absolutely, do that. And then they're like, oh, I want to figure out what it is, and then they'll be wasting time trying to figure it out. And it just disrupts, like, a lot of players who have, like, fallen into ruts. Like, it's a dragon, all right, everybody, don't use your sleep spells because he's immune, and dodge poison and stuff like that. So that's one way that I think really works. And you don't even have to do it on the spot. You can go through and pick three or four creatures in the adventure path and just... use a post-it note and write down a three-line description. It smells like cinnamon, has wasp wings, its tail hisses, and you're off to the races.
Its tail looks like a fidget spinner.
So I got actually a pretty good segue, because my question is about published adventures, and when you guys are DMing a home game, how often you use a published adventure from somebody else, whether it's Bruce Cordell's Gates of Firestorm Peak or something else. And then, of course, a specific story like, hey, when I was doing Gates of Firestorm Peak or, you know, another one, this is what I changed or this is how I changed, you know, and this is the, you know, something like that, some kind of good.
I don't really use Adventure Pass too much just because I came up very... you know, not poor, but as a kid, just not being able to afford, like, any of the splat books. We'd share players' handbooks, and it would be lucky if we could have the monster manual for the week and stuff like that. So we kind of made most of our stuff by hand, but recently I've, like, got into just reading and adapting, like, more iconic pieces of that, just like just slotting them into whatever I have. But one of the coolest ways, I think, that you can... kind of modify stuff is just you can take old sorts of content that, like, applies to your specific adventure and then just put that in to, like, to adventure stuff that's already prepared, and that makes it feel a lot less you know, a lot less standardized and a lot more personal. And, you know, depending on how, like, if you just pepper in stuff like that, you know, it doesn't even necessarily feel like you're reading out of it. It just feels like organically part of what everyone's kind of building. And that's one of my ways that I like to incorporate content. I mean, I think that's a very basic one that everyone does, but it's I don't know. It's just, you know, you read certain kind of tropes, like a razor fountain of diamonds and stuff like that. It's just,
can you give an example, like when you were doing Wolfgang Bauer's Kingdom of the Ghouls or something? Or
I mean,
I was just talking to him about it.
The one thing I remember recently is just literally the basic adventure path that I think is in the starter box, because we were playing with a bunch of new players. And that's just, I mean, you know, it's very basic. It's like, there's goblins and there's, like, a goblin dog or something like that. So, like, you just reskin some of the monsters so they're kind of, like, strange humanoids, and then you just kind of adjust the trappings so it's less of a standard cave and more like a strange alien sort of, like, hive, and it's like, is this a blight on the land? And, you know, it's just kind of using the same trappings, but really, I mean, it's really kind of what you're saying. But that's just because I don't use very many adventure paths. But I can't even name one that's like a name, like you said, the Firestorm. Like, I've never even heard of that. So I don't think I have very much familiarity with it.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to pretty much always play and run homebrew stuff. But as we got older, the most world that I think that I played in that's outside of Galarian is actually funny that you should mention him in Midgard, Wolfgang's Midgard campaign setting that he's had running for however many odd years now. And so I used to actually run those convention scenarios at Gen Con, at Paizo Con, at some other local cons where I lived. And I think that I was very much like what James is describing. We had pre-gens for folks, but I was like, hey, you know, Wolfgang's got a lot of character options. If you want to make your own characters, bring your own characters. And every once in a while, there was one time in specific, we were running an adventure called Devil's Chocolate, and people had made all their own characters, and that's in a city of gnomes that have a pack of demons. And so they've got to go through this like chocolatier shop and they have to figure out what's going on. And it turns out, you know, the proprietor is actually not a gnome, is, you know, it was an evil outsider sort of in disguise. And there was a gnome in the party and they sort of worked in some stuff where like this gnome was related to somebody and they were trying to figure out what's off about this person, what's off about them. And so just making it a little more connected to the actual PCs. Kind of on the fly, just little stuff like that. And I think people, it really sort of became this intrigue type of adventure that, you know, it might not otherwise have been. So just little stuff that you can come up with.
I ran a campaign for several years, set in Sandpoint, for basically a bunch of people in Kaizo. And the idea of that campaign, I had basic ideas. Like there was a lot of that stuff that seeped into the campaign somehow, like the Inactive Hours, Midnight Milk, and drugs and all this weird stuff, but it's busy working at Kaizo, so it's like I wanted to run basically it's sort of a sandbox type game set in Sandpoint. I told all the players make characters that would live in Sandpoint or would be in Sandpoint for some reason, and had an initial like hook. It's like, oh, this some kid went missing in the old creepy manor up the hill. Go check it out and track him down. And the main resource I was using for that whole thing was Keep on the Borderlands, which is one of the super, super oldest adventures. And it's basically built in this format that's like, it's kind of a valley, and there's like all these different caves along the valley. And each one goes to the Kobold Dungeon, one goes to the Orc Dungeon, one goes to the Minotaur Maze, one goes to the Ghoul Temple. And there's this place in the Sandpoint Hinterlands called the Pit, which is this big hole in the ground where the Sandpoint Devil is. I knew I wanted it at one point to have the Sandpoint Devil come after it. But I didn't have time to design this whole mega deck, so I basically just used Keep on the Borderlands and replaced the kobolds with goblins, and I replaced like the orcs with darrows, and there was like a Lovecraft cultist down there and stuff like that. And it really worked pretty well. I kind of sort of used just the map from the inside cover. And some of the ideas, and then I had like a piece of paper that I drew a circle and kind of said like, all right, this is a Spriggan cave or whatever, a Darrow cave or a Driver cave. And the end result was very different than Keep on the Borderlands, but it really helped having that. And since I've run that adventure and read it so many times, it helped have in the back of my mind sort of a structure to wing on.
So probably since its release, I've been have this strange obsession with the Temple of Elemental Evil.
Playing it right now.
Yeah, and I'm running it as a lunch game right now. And every time I run it, it's a little bit different. So my lunch group, I started out the campaign that they were arrested for beating Elmo into a coma. And I didn't tell them the reason who started the fight or anything else. That was for them to decide. This was sort of the penance that they had to do to go check out the moat house for it. Yeah, every time I run that, it's a little bit different because I pick up on some nuances of NPCs, or I find some ancient source by some Gragnard who played it the first time with Gary. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of a cool idea. I'm going to run with that. Or I just think I have a better idea. So, yeah, I think I've run that adventure probably about 6 times, and every time it's a little bit different.
What about eaten by the frogs?
What's that?
Did somebody get eaten by the frogs?
I actually, this time, the frog was dead.
What?
And there was a giant spider in that, with a tunnel in that.
Right. Did anybody ever kill Prince Thrommel?
No, they're looking for him now, though. They have a cameo with a picture, and they like, his body was never recovered.
Ran for all of the developers. It was originally going to be, this is the developer game, but we had 4 or 5 developers. And it's like, I'm going to run, because Rob McCurry was like, I've never played in Temple of Elemental Evil. Like, the other team just started their game, and so that game went for one session. But my game that I got tricked into running ran for like years and years, and in the meantime we hired like 25 more developers, so by the end of the game we had like a stadium of people in it, and John Compton was in there like being super pedantically mapping the entire place.
Oh, yeah.
And
yep.
Even though he was super, super just anally making sure everything was covered, they got all the way to the bottom and they never found Prince Thrommel's chambers until the very end. It was like I was like, Steve's, there's a blank spot on your map right here. Basically, at the NPC plan. Well, you see, there's something going on there. Maybe you should go check it out. Wink, wink.
Nudge, nudge.
So, yeah. But that happened, like, at the very end of the campaign, and so they didn't really get a lot of the
he got distracted by the stupid stuff in that game.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of stuff, yeah.
When I was about, I don't know, when I was about 20, I had a home campaign where it was Undermountain, and one of my players, who's still a good player, Mickey, yeah, he mapped large sections of that, got these massive pieces of graph paper, and you go, and he like posted them up in his home, and so I go, and he's like, I think we're gonna go here next time. This is where I want to go. And everything else that campaign ran for a couple of years. It's amazing when you get a dedicated mapper how obsessed they become.
and to the point where they miss things.
Oh yeah,
it's
yeah.
Awesome.
So Spencer on Harmon Quest and particularly Harmontown, a lot of times Dan will bring somebody on the show who has not only no Pathfinder experience, but no gaming experience at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm always interested on how you bring these people in and get them to understand how the game plays. So
I don't think there's too much, especially on Harmontown, just as a quick background, if anyone's unfamiliar, we do a comedy podcast that films in front of a live audience, so it's very much a comedy show where the intent is to entertain people, and as a segment, we play D&D on it, and by nature of that, it's a lot less normal than what you'd expect from role-playing games. So we have special guests on our show, and sometimes they come and play with us, and so, yeah, I don't talk to most of them at all about playing. Sometimes it's said that they're going to leave and they're not going to stick around, and then they stick around and it's like, oh, snap.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when I do get the chance to talk to them, I just say it's kind of like long-form improv because we're dealing with like Hollywood people that act and they know all this Hollywood stuff. And so those are the ways I try to frame it.
Yeah.
But it's like there's not a lot of ways to explain, oh, we're playing pretend. Like, you know, D&D and role-playing games are such a concept that are hard. It's hard to explain without like demonstrations or examples that but when you explain it in terms of improv to someone who might have been to an improv class in college or something, then they get on board, and then you say, it's like improv, but you can't just say anything. I can just say anything, but you just got to be your characters. And that's about as much as I do, but mostly I just say, do what you want to do, I'll tell you what happens, I'll explain it, listen, imagine the things happening, and try and say what you want to do, and I'll help you out. And that's just kind of what I have done. Because in my experience, I've played with a lot of new players, and also in my experience, there's a tendency to overburden new players with a lot of information and all sorts of gameplay, especially Magic the Gathering or role-playing games. And I find the less you tell them, the more they're just into it, because the less that confuses them. And that's also how we developed the style in Harmontown of me rolling all the dice.
Yeah.
Is with newer players, it's a lot easier to just say, hey, roll that dice. And then fill them in as you go. So if you say, I attack, you say, hey, roll that dice. And then you ask them for their attack bonus or whatever. And then as you go, say, hey, you know, say that number and then add the attack bonus and all that stuff. And then you just kind of slowly build. And then they're learning how to play after a couple sessions, or they know the basics and they're having fun. And if you don't know what you're doing, but you're having fun, you're going to come back.
Yeah.
And, or you're going to be comfortable enough to be comedic on stage. But if you don't know what you're going to do, you're kind of just hanging back and you might not come back and you might not have a good time. So that's kind of what I want to emphasize, is just making sure they feel comfortable participating.
Thanks.
In your experience, what's the easiest way to dissuade players from focusing on an NPC that was a one-time kind of throwaway character or something? Everybody's in love with this NPC, and you're just like, they're just the baker. What do you guys tend to do in this circumstance?
That is one of the greatest gifts your players can give you as a GM. If you're like just playing the game, and all of a sudden you're like, back to Temple of Elemental Evil, they went to the moneylender, and he's like, in the adventure, he doesn't even have money. It's just the moneylender will give you, it has all of these rules for like the exchange rates. If you give him 12 silver pieces, you'll get back 6 copper pieces or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's boring. And so I was just kind of bored myself. It's like, they go to the moneylender, it's like, all right, you go in, and he's this big guy, and he's obviously having trouble breathing, but he's just eating from this wheel of cheese. Just
like,
Let me get some money. Okay, let me get ready. He pushes the cheese out of the way. What do you want? I'm gonna help. And they immediately just obsessed with this guy. Like, oh, geez, he's the moneylender. He's like the financial economic backbone of Hamlet, and he's gonna have a heart attack right now. And they started getting all into it, like, oh, you're right, sir. Can we go get you some? Oh, I'm fine. I just had a little bit of, no, I'm okay. And so the moneylender stuck in their head, and they're always like, oh, yeah, that moneylender. I hope he's okay. And then at some point, you know, there's, spoiler alert, there's assassins in Hamlet. At that point, I didn't want to necessarily kill off the player characters, because that's kind of a jerk move right at the start of the campaign. But I killed off the moneylender. It's like, and the player characters got blamed for it. It was like, you guys were the last people seen at his place, and now he's dead. So that really got them all invested in the game and excited about that, all because they just kind of happened to latch onto the moneylender that I made a funny voice for. So I would, if you have the player characters get really into an NPC, milk it for all it's worth. Make that character important. If the adventure says that the princess gets kidnapped by the dragon, nope, it's the postman gets kidnapped by the dragon.
That's definitely the easiest thing to do. Is just motivation can be really hard. I mean, people are motivated to do all sorts of stuff, but they can be really hard to be motivated to do the story you want to tell a lot of times, I've found. So if you have them attached to an NPC, then the NPC can have them want whatever your adventure is, and then they'll naturally kind of go in that direction, and if they don't, you know, kill them off. And, force them down that path. But, I find that once you get an NPC that they're attached to, like, that just becomes, like, him and his friends and his network, and you can build out every other NPC, not necessarily, like, every NPC knows who this guy is, but, like, in terms of connections and groups, it's really easy to build out, and so, like, the next guy you talk to is, it's this guy at this guild, and he knows the NPC's brother or something, and then, you know, then the third step is, like, that guild has connections to some other entity, but then there's a more personal connection that feels very, intentional when it's completely just going off the energy of what your players are already in pursuit of, and I think that's it's a great way to add cohesion and kind of investment to what you already want to do.
As a sidetrack to that question real quick, if you're doing like a murder mystery, those are the hardest things to run because you've got to build all these clues and stuff like that, and the game table's always distracting. If the player characters think they solve the mystery and you're looking at their solution, it's like, that kind of makes sense, change the adventure entirely so that's the solution. And all of a sudden, your player characters feel like they're smart because they figured out. Even better, they think you're the best GM ever because you made all the perfect clues for them just barely.
They don't know any better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think good and bad consequences are really important. Mm-hmm. So if you've got your players who have just had this really long interaction with an NPC that was unnamed in the adventure, whatever came out of that interaction should be something that carries forward, so that maybe it is somebody that they come back and go see, or maybe, you know, somebody was a real jerk and bullied them. You know, I used to have players all the time that would try to throw their weight around and stuff because, oh, it's just the NPC, you know, it's just the baker or whatever. And it's like, oh, no, the baker was actually, you know, the son-in-law of the mayor, and now this mayor has it out for you, and everything you're trying to do now in this town is a lot harder, and so that motivates them to go back, maybe do some other type of thing, and it makes the story feel a lot more real and dynamic rather than just like they were mean to a baker and then nobody ever mentions it again and the baker never says anything when they go back and stuff like that.
Then the baker invented power armor.
That was the old days, right? You never started a fight with a bartender because he was some retired 20th level fighter who, you know, all he does is set up drinks now, but you start a fight with him and you're done.
Yeah, I mean, some of it goes back to what I was saying about how you adjust, you know, adventure paths or whatnot. There is this tendency because we get, you know, adventures packaged in these nice, shiny, with lots of art, so you've got to run it like that. That is just the wrong way to go. With role-playing games. Those should be starting points, those should be way markers, those are there to help you out. But you were presenting a story, but you really don't have a whole lot of control over it. The players have a whole lot of control. And anytime, I wrote a column a long time ago on the Save My Game for the Wizard of the Coast website, where there is this tendency to think that when you're creating an adventure, you're a novelist, right? And all you just need to do is have the characters do what you wrote. And it's actually you're the producer of a reality show where you throw them in situations and see what they do, and then struggle to kind of keep up and always be one step ahead of them and adjust the story to make sure that they have an awesome time. And if you can really embrace that, not only are your players going to think you're the best fucking GM ever, right? You're gonna if you can embrace it, you're gonna have a great time. Back there. We'll start then. Let's roll away this way.
Do you have any good stories about that one player who, for whatever reason, always wanted to play an evil character?
Oh, yeah, I'm that player.
Yeah. I've actually had Steven in my game. Well, actually, we were all evil characters.
Yeah, we were all evil.
So that's kind of the point of that game. But everybody does. And I would not say the one character that wants to play the evil character. I would say the one player that wants to play the disruptive character. And in my experience, that's the paladin.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No other class has so many restrictions on what they do and what you can do with than the paladin. And so you get, if you get a paladin in your group, you've got every other player in the party wants to see the paladin fall. And the paladin wants every other person in the party to do what they say. And you as the GM are like, it's frustrating. I mean, I just use the paladin because that's the one that comes up so often for me, but it's also the one where it's like, we're going to run like Skull and Shackles. So everybody, you got to basically play, and again, that's one where it's like, I want to play a paladin. I want to play somebody who's afraid of the water. invariably, we see whenever we announce an adventure path, like Iron Fang Invasion comes up, where it's basically the hobgoblins band up and attack the town, and you're fighting against hobgoblins, and invariably, like, one of the first people says, I want to play a hobgoblin. it's tricky. I mean, one of the tricky parts about role-playing games is that it's a team sport. And the party has to work together in order to, you know, do this story and to develop it. And a lot of people want to be the star of the show. And you can't be the star in a team. Well, you can, but then it causes disruptions and stuff like that. So it's tricky. I mean, if you're comfortable with a character that wants to play the evil character and everybody else is good, roll with it. It really requires consent for the group. I mean, I wouldn't just spring it on the group out of the blue. I would sit down with them and be like, hey, Joe wants to play an evil character. You guys all cool with that? Because it's uncool to basically ruin a game because somebody is trying to sell it. So that's kind of a rambling answer.
I think you're right. And also make sure that the person is doing it for really good reasons. I love to play kind of oddball, disruptive characters because I'm easily bored and I like to entertain myself. currently I'm playing this cleric in a campaign, and he's basically very, like, he's a cleric of a war god, but he's very amoral. He's not evil most of the time, but he does say things like, why don't we just keep the treasure and not give it to the tax person? Or, oh yeah, somebody might own this, but we could just murder them and keep it. And, you know, and he never really kind of goes out of his way to do that, and it causes a lot of good laughs. But some people actually want, I like to play those characters because they're fun. And I can also use it as comedy to entertain the rest of the group. Some people just like to watch the world burn, and don't let those people anywhere near a role-playing game. And it's your duty to say, no. But explaining consent and telling them it is a group effort, making sure that their intentions are pure, that they want to help create a really good story amongst a bunch of friends, because that's what these games really, really do. And if they just want to be too much of a pain in the ass, go, man, you're being a jerk. Stop it.
Yeah, usually if you have buy-in from that player who wants to play sort of the oddball character with a different alignment or a different class, or, you know, something like that, or some sort of secret, you know, that they're trying to hide from the rest of the party. Yeah. Actually, like, being super clear, not only to get the consent of the other players, but being very clear with that player that it's like, okay, if this goes off the rails, if this starts to go bad, you know, we're going to have to go in another direction. And I've had that happen from a mechanic standpoint. I let a player play converted version of an old 3.5 class, and it was super overpowered, and they were like one-shotting these bad guys and the old swashbuckler. So it was converted, and it's like, well, this maybe looks okay, and then it turns out it was crazy, it was overpowered, and it's like, okay. Took him aside and was like, this is not working out very well. The other players are not getting the stage time. You know, your character, something has to give here. And he's like, yeah, I kind of figured. And I'm like, I'm going to kill your character next session. And he's like, yeah, that's fair. And then he remade a different character in an actual Pathfinder class, and it was fine. So that could have gone really nasty if the player was very, like, into, no, I must play this class.
Yeah, that's a good point. I had a player in one of my games at one point, Jason Nelson, who runs Legendary Games, and he was playing a psychic character from Sonic's Handbook, and he had somehow figured out a way to summon monsters as a free action, and he would focus on summoning monsters as a free action that could themselves summon monsters as a free action. And when his turn came around, it took an hour. And I basically, after a couple sessions of this, is like, you won. You won, your character needs to be turned into a new character. And he was cool with that, because it's like, yeah, fair enough. I can see that everybody else is frustrated whenever my turn comes up. In a case like that, just let him remake the character. Don't do anything like retry, you have to retrain and all this stuff. Just
or kill him.
Now, for those of you who do want to play the disruptive character, because it's hella fun, just make sure that when it is your turn, your turns are very quick. No one gets mad at you for hogging the spotlight. You can just have sort of surgical disruption.
Yeah, you don't. If you're evil, you don't necessarily have to have your way. You could just go along with the group and be upset about it. I don't know. I feel like I play a lot of bad characters, mostly because I like monstrous characters, and I just think that most monsters tend to be, you know, eviler and stuff. But we've had more problems with, like what you were saying, paladins and clerics who have some perverted sense of morality, and it always devolves into these arguments. It's like, we keep just trusting these people and not killing them, and they keep taking all our stuff and leaving us shanghaied, and, you know, and the whole government is killing all the babies and snoring them as cocaine. There's no reason to obey any laws of the land, and we've never been any consequences, and everyone we've ever met has been utterly evil. And so, like, I was the evil person in that group, but that was the right thing to do in that world, is because everyone was just complicit in, you know, killing everyone's babies and snorting them. But we would have arguments about how that wasn't the right thing to do. And say, these people snort babies! So, I don't know. You know, I think you could be evil and still be a good team player. And sometimes, you know, you could be really causing problems being evil. But,
you know, this isn't a popular view, but some babies are made or born to be snorted.
Well, not all of them, though. That's the
There's different grades of babies. Okay, let's see. We'll go here.
I guess my big question is something that's actually come up in my homebrew campaign twice now. What do you do when you've been running like half a year, you've got a lot of storyline invested in one character, and that guy gets bored with his character and gets himself murdered? And you've just got these hanging story bits, and you're like,
you punish the players here. Well, a beating will do.
Yes. Obviously. But from a, I guess, a campaign point of view, how do you recover those? Move on?
I've had that happen a couple of times where a player character just, they get bored, or their character dies, or they move, or something like that. There's all sorts of things that can happen. One of the truths about being a GM is not everything that you create is going to get used in the game that you wanted to create for. And so if something like that happens, you're like, oh, that sucks. Take that storyline or whatever, and if there's no way to work it into the new character, and no way to really work it into the existing character, set it aside, put it in a folder, save it for later. And you never know what's going to happen next year, or 10 years, or 20 years down the road. I mean, like, just a couple years ago, we got to a point where it's like, we need a map for a city, and it needs to be turned over to the art team, like, tomorrow. And the artist, or the adventure writer, can't draw maps, so I went back to all of these old maps that I did back in college like 20 years ago. I was like, oh, here's a city map, we have to use it, and just throw it in there. And that's kind of an extreme case, but something you don't use today could be something you use tomorrow, the next year, or whatever. So just keep, and then start building it up, and you'll get to a point where you've got like a little stockpile of plot points and things like that. But in the meantime, just get used to the idea that sometimes really cool ideas will never see the light of day. And there's always another idea coming.
Time for a couple more questions.
Do you like having your players write backgrounds, and how do you, any tips for incorporating them into your game?
I would say that pretty much every campaign I think I've ever run, even some like shorter, even one-shot sometimes, I ask them to write a page of background and give it to me within a couple of weeks before we start the game, and I usually get varying amounts of text. Like, I had somebody write an entire 14-page short story one time to explain the background of his half-orc,
you never
think, alchemist.
That.
I would never do such a thing. And then every once in a while, you know, it'll just be like a couple sentences or two, but I require that sort of thing, or I at least ask for folks to do that because... specifically because I do want to be able to incorporate it, so I take note of, you know, the important pieces of information that they're providing. You know, where were they born, who were their parents, what in their background affected them, why did they decide to do the training of the character class that they're in, what is, you know, something that they hate, if they have some sort of phobia, is there something that I can build into the storyline and, you know, have NPCs recall the backstory of, oh, you're so-and-so's son, or you're so-and-so's daughter, or I heard about this thing and they said that it was somebody who had this scar and they've got the same scar on your face. Like, was that you? Oh, you know, I'm scared of you or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, like, any little thing to sort of, like, thread it into the story is, I think, more engaging for players, and players start to sort of, like, look for it or start to think, like, oh, man, maybe this person heard about this terrible thing that I did or that... you know, that my cousin did, and everybody blames me for it, or something like that. So, yeah, like, I recommend everybody do that. It's more work, but it's more fun.
It is, but it really, I mean, that's really where the trait system came from, because that's something I would do in my campaigns is before I start a campaign. And I know, for example, if this is a campaign where player characters are unknowingly agents of Servant Cold, and they're going to get embroiled in this war. And before the campaign started, I give them like a little handout sheet that says, all right, you've got to make your characters and pick one of these backgrounds for your elements for your characters. Like, you've got a weird scar on your face, or you're afraid of, you know, bears or whatever, stuff like that. And I would know that, like, for example, the one with the bear fear, there's like a werebear faction I'm going to be playing in that game. Mm-hmm. And so you can basically and make sure that all of these options give the player characters free things. Like, you're afraid of bears, and that makes you super jumpy, so you get a +4 initiative bonus. And so that gets people involved right away. It's like, oh, if I pick this background for my character, I get a little benefit from my character, and then they accidentally create something that you use.
Are you familiar with the horror game Dread? Is anybody in here familiar with that game? Yeah, so that game gives you 10 questions, and they're very random, and they're different for each type of character in the scenario that you're running in. And it will say, you know, like, you experienced something terrible that has given you a phobia from your first mission. What was it? And, you know, a lot of the stuff is just, like, super random stuff that never comes up, but sometimes as a GM, that can be sort of a good, like, writing exercise for the player to think about their character, and, you know, then you can build that stuff in as you see fit.
Yeah, cribbing stuff from other games that take a stronger approach to backgrounding is a great option. That's really simple.
All right, back there.
So you talked earlier about how you ran a game where there were two people that met and they eventually got married.
Yeah.
How do you handle a situation where there is a couple that wants to play together? So as a GM, they want to play together, but their styles are so different, they should never be in a game together ever.
Oh, man. Well, the funny thing about it is this couple was a little bit like that too, right? He was, he settled down a lot, but he used to stomp out of the game over, like, little stuff, and she was the most even-keeled person that I know. I don't know. I'm the type of person where the only really... advice I can give you is just tell them to settle their shit. That's how I deal with it. It might not be the
best.
Well,
I mean, gaming styles. So, like, one is a little more role playing focused, the other is a little more hack and slash focused.
Yep.
And so they both don't really mesh well together as players in a game.
Well, I mean, you're going to have that with any kind of group, just in general. And again, the trick is to more look at it as kind of a reality TV show. It's I know the group of players in front of me, and I know what they like, and I am going to create stories and challenges where everybody is at least a little bit happy, if not gloriously happy by the end of the thing. And in a lot of ways, I found that people actually start to figure out the joys of other aspects of role-playing. And all of a sudden, the person who is way deep in story goes, oh, wait, yeah, let's go beat the crap out of this. And the other person gets out of their shell and says, no, I'll talk to the king this time. Yeah, I don't think there's a magic bullet. I think it's kind of more, if you can't do tough love, then do therapy. Right, you show them the other side and let the chips kind of fall where they may.
Time for a couple more.
Yep. We'll get to this side of the room. So yeah.
Okay. So from my experience as a GM, I've noticed that a lot of other GMs have particular rule sets that sometimes get hand waved. Mine, in particular, with Pathfinder, is the fly rules. I feel like I just kind of...
Oh, yeah, you should tell Jason that
I'm just... They're not that bad, but it's like in the moment, I just kind of have to roll and just figure it out unless I happen to be looking right at that part on my GM screen.
Yeah.
I'm just curious with you guys what maybe that one rule for you guys is.
Encumbrance is the one that I think most people...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
like, coin encumbrance.
Yeah, or like other elements like coin, numismatics, and stuff like that. It's like the pennies and gold pieces and everything and Corvosa are different than they are in Katapesh, and what's the trade interaction with that. And it's not really, if it's not fun for you, don't put it in your game. And what's fun for you is not necessarily what's in the game. So that's very important.
Experience points are garbage.
Yeah. I agree.
I do in... World of Darkness and Exalted and stuff, I think they have like stunt bonuses, but also, I mean, stunts kind of amount to just letting people improvise elements of stuff, so there's a lot of things I kind of just let people stunt if it doesn't have a huge impact. Like, you could resolve a complex series of attacks and combat maneuvers, like, pretty easily, but if it's not actually meaning to do a combat maneuver thing, like push someone or pin someone, you could just resolve it like a normal attack and let them be cool and dynamic in that moment, and that goes a long way. But also, like, drowning and swimming stuff, I kind of just use different stuff because no one ever seems to, like, put any skill ranks into anything that helps swimming, and I don't understand drowning, and the drowning rules seem either, like, way not dramatic enough or way too much. It's like you have way too much free time until the very end, and then it's just a bunch of dice rolling and dying.
But it turns into Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
The best way to deal with the drowning and suffocation rules is actually live-action roleplay.
So yeah, all your advice, choke your players, send them out in the woods so they get lost.
Right.
In 50 pounds of plate mail, too.
All right, I think we probably have one more question.
We'll go way back there. Most GMs seem to start as kids with playing with their friends. What advice do you guys have for an adult that's starting a GM?
Well, one obvious result is both kids. I mean, they are super imaginative. They are a lot of what I've seen kids who come up with, like, really creative solutions to games. But at the same point, just find it. It can be tough finding other people to, or in games, but like today it's a lot easier, I think, than when back in the day, because there's like video games, and like Game of Thrones is one of the most popular things on TV, and you can really, you know, get people interested in fantasy or superhero or science fiction games right now just by looking at movies. Like, you saw the Avengers movie, why don't you want to, you can do that type of thing in this game.
You do it on Roll 20 too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So.
D&D streaming, live streaming is something that just didn't used to exist, so as an adult, if you want to avail yourself of just real versions of real people playing D&D and other role-playing games, I think that it's really easy to just find it and learn from that. That's something I'm kind of terrified of, but it's you know, the hardest thing for me to find growing up was just anyone else that was doing it. And so it's like, am I just making something up and calling it like 3.5? But now you can just see what other people are doing and see, oh, this is great. This is stupid. Like, this guy's bad at this. He's good at this. And that's something that simply didn't exist for a long time. And it does now.
Yeah, I would recommend if you can play at least a little bit at first, and if you can play in person, because it's one thing to, you know, like read about somebody's session, it's one thing to watch it, which is really good. I mean, that's great for understanding how things flow, but it's really difficult to sort of just grasp all the nuances of what the GM actually has to do until you're one of the players and you're actually like observing how somebody is running. So like if you have the opportunity, if you know someone who's a good GM, or if you have a Pathfinder Society Lodge or something, just play a couple of games. Yeah, and then before you give it a shot, because that does a lot to take away the nerves as well, because there's a lot of just like, what's going to happen? I don't know what the players are going to do. How do I react when somebody does something that's not in the scenario? And just playing and getting some experience under your belt can help.
I think the answer is actually really simple and very difficult. And I think as we get older and become adults, we don't try new things because we're afraid of failing. Don't be afraid of failing, because you will. It's a complicated game. Being a GM is a monumental task that only, you know, the crazy folks kind of do. But if you really want to do it, yeah, just embrace it and fumble through all the bad crap, because that's how you get better.
Yeah. Don't be too hard on yourself.
Right. You know, that's a great thing about being a kid. They don't care.
But you got to keep the goal in mind.
What's that?
You got to keep the goal in mind.
No, I'm not a big fan of goals.
For everybody to enjoy themselves?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we came, right?
That's great.
Well, thank you, everybody.
He is the evil player, after all.
I mean, you still like me, and I kill you how many times?
That is the sign of a good GM.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.